call to order the meeting of Monday, August 26th, of the planning commission to order. David, would you please take the roll?
Yes. Chairman Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Demarest?
Here.
Commissioner Dirksen is excused. Commissioner Jensen?
Here.
Commissioner Rodman?
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood?
Here.
And Commissioner Tuttle is excused.
Thank you, David. Okay, now is the time we set aside for comments from citizens. The citizens, the audience can make any comments they want that is not on tonight's agenda. Any comments that you may can be or may not be, don't have to take action on it tonight or comment on it tonight, but most times we do. So just to let you know, that's the case here. So anybody, I don't have a list of any sign-ups.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate. I'd like to make a few comments that reinforce.
Can you step up to the,
sure,
the mic and give your,
yeah,
name and address?
Yep.
For the record, please.
My name is Jeff Rogers. I'm at 127 East Rivermont in Monroe. And I had a few comments with respect to reinforcing a letter that you should have all received from Lowell Anderson and myself concerning the East Monroe proposed actions.
Okay, the East Monroe is on tonight's agenda.
I understand.
So we're asking that, you know, if we have comments, to limit them to things that are not.
So will I have any chance to comment later tonight?
Yeah, sure. I think we could.
Okay.
When we get into to that discussion.
Fair. Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome. Anybody else? Any comments that are not on tonight's agenda? Okay. And next item is approval of minutes. We have minutes from July 22nd. I don't have a chance to read fully. Commissioner?
I would make a motion to approve minutes July 22, 2013, as written.
Second.
Motion made by Commissioner Demarest to approve the minutes for July 22nd, seconded by Commissioner Rodman. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you. We do not have a public hearing tonight. So the next thing we have is a workshop. The workshop, part A, is on the CPA 2011-01 East Monroe draft environmental impact statement. Paul, I'm going to let you take the floor.
We're here tonight to introduce this draft environmental impact statement. The whole objective of tonight is to give you an introduction to this document and some background that we can all consider as we move forward in the next several weeks with the comp plan amendment for the property. Now, you, at least I'm sure we all recall that a year ago the council adopted an ordinance to change the land use and the zoning for this property, but an appeal of the phased EIS that was prepared last year was taken to the hearing examiner, and the hearing examiner did find for the appellants that phased EIS was inadequate. That the result of that was to undo the ordinance for the East Monroe property, so it gets back to where we first began. But since then, the property owner commissioned a full environmental impact statement, and with that comes a reinitiation of the comp plan amendment and subsequent rezoning process. But tonight we're here to talk about the environmental impact statement. Questions, discussion. We do have a consultant here tonight that's going to make a presentation. And I should say that the discussion is not about the comp plan. It's certainly they're related, the comp plan and the eventual rezoning are certainly related to the EIS, but our discussion is really about what's in this environmental impact statement, how it's being handled, and what questions there might be for this information. I want to introduce, first, I think you've met Melissa Sartorius,
yes.
Planner. She's also our SEEP official. And Susan Boyd is here from PACE Engineers to share some information with you.
Thank you.
My turn? Let's see if you can.
Oh.
Oh, I guess we need light. Thank you, Paul. As Paul mentioned, my name is Susan Boyd. I'm with PACE Engineers. PACE Engineers has been hired as the lead consultant by the Heritage Baptist Fellowship, the owners of the property involved in this proposed action. I'm a principal at PACE. I lead their planning group. With me tonight is Christina Long right here and Megan Hawkins. They were chief authors of the EIS. We also have with us Kathy Minnick, who's in the back row, the property owner that we represent here tonight, as well as Phil Chessman, who's a fellow vice president of mine at PACE Engineers and heads our development services group. So that's our PACE team. Assisting us on this project was a whole team of scientists and consultants. We retain the services of Wetland Resources, Scott Brainerd in particular, super guy, super biologist, knows more about wetlands and streams in Snohomish County than any other consultant I know of or have worked closely with. Gibson Traffic Consultants provided us with the traffic input and additional analysis regarding traffic and transportation. And geoengineers, Deb Overbay, a professional engineer with geoengineers, helped us out with some of the geotechnical investigations, steep slope concerns, that sort of thing. This team has been together over a period of several months now, working very hard on this project, has performed a lot of site recon, a lot of in-depth analysis, and has come up with an EIS, a draft EIS, that I think goes far above and beyond anything that has been looked at in this property in the past. The EIS process, if you will, I just will briefly, is that on August 14th, a draft EIS was issued, starting a 30-day comment period. Tonight, we've come here to provide an introduction to the draft EIS to the Planning Commission. We'd like to talk to you about our goals, our objectives, and our basic findings of the draft EIS. We didn't come here with the scientists, the traffic, the wetlands people, and the geotechnical engineers are not with me tonight, kind of specifically so that we could focus on the higher level stuff. And then on, next week already is September, on September 5th, have a formal public hearing with a more detailed presentation for you. One of my goals tonight is to hear your concerns so that we can focus those into a very meaningful public hearing and present more of the science behind what we've been through over the past several months. The 30-day comment period on the draft EIS ends on Friday the 13th of September. 2 weeks after that, we anticipate having a final EIS issue. The final EIS will address all the comments that are received to the draft and propose a final action with hopefully any of the questions answered or ironed out. A final action is expected on this early to mid-December. We were hoping to get this to the council before the Thanksgiving holiday, but really held back a little bit so that we could make sure that every I was crossed and all the analysis was there and absolutely complete so that this was an easier, more straightforward decision-making process. So with that in mind, we have set some goals for ourselves that are fairly aggressive, working hard towards them, and hope that we have the continued support of Melissa and Paul going forward. They've been a tremendous help to us so far, and we look forward to that continued relationship over the next few months. The proposed action, not a whole lot different than what has been talked about in the past. It's a proposal for a rezone from limited open space to general commercial. The proposed action really seeks in this case to find the highest and best use of the property. It acknowledges that the property is within the urban growth area. It acknowledges that all agencies, when they establish their urban growth areas, were looking to concentrate development within that UGA line and find the highest and best use so that we could preserve the more rural areas of our state. The property is on the eastern side of Monroe, and it differs, see if I can make the point of work here, it differs from the old proposal in this parcel F has been left off. The previous proposal was for 68, a little over 68 acres. Today we're looking at just under 43 acres. The parcel F is under different ownership, and I don't know how many of you were on the Planning Commission when this went through last year, but parcel F does not have as much analysis or evaluation behind it as the properties that are under the Heritage Baptist Fellowship ownership. And so a decision was made to leave them off and to proceed ahead with the EIS under those that fund it, basically. The 2013 draft EIS is new, it's expanded, it's thicker, it's more detailed. It's based on, again, the reduced project area. It's based on a lot of public comment that's been received over the years. We poured through all of that information, trying to answer all the questions that have been brought forward over the past few years. We put a lot of solace in the hearing examiner's comments. The hearing examiner basically, in my opinion, found that the draft EIS was, it might have met the letter of the CEPA law, but it didn't really provide the background information and the meat of the material that someone unfamiliar with Monroe or unfamiliar with the parcel would be able to infer from the draft EIS. So we went further. We went deeper. We looked at extent, at codes, regulations, standard practices, engineering best practices to figure out what could be done with the property and what should be done with the property. We did all this to both evaluate the rezone action itself and to go a little further and talk about the likely development, the likely impacts associated with potential development. And you'll hear me talk about potential development what's throughout the EIS and tonight. In the terms of alternatives or development scenarios, we came up with three alternatives, like a project EIS would, and did a comparative analysis of those alternatives. The expanded analyses really focused on the critical areas, the wetlands, the shorelands, the floodplains, the steep slopes, traffic and transportation, and then the cumulative impacts to the environment and the community that the hearing examiner did find was insufficient in the past EIS. The alternatives, alternative one, the no action alternative, is required under CEPA. No action means that you would retain the current zoning of limited open space. Under limited open space, there's a host of things that are possible, chicken farms and cement plants and churches and schools, health facilities like gyms and that kind of thing. Alternative two, our proposed action, is rezoned to a general commercial, which would allow for a variety of general commercial activities, as implied. And then alternative three that we looked at was a rezoned to mixed-use commercial, and that differs from alternative two in that we thought it prudent to consider, well, what if it was mixed-use? What if it was an office complex? Mixed use extends to allow for multi-family development or a retirement home or that kind of thing. And so to give a complete alternative, worst case scenarios or best case scenarios, depending on who you ask, we included the mixed use commercial alternative. The starting point for us was really to look at on-site constraints and limitations. The site is shown here. I think I'm not very good at these, so bear with me here. The site basically comes around like this. Its highest or its biggest defining factor is the stream that you see go through it. We call it the Oxbow Stream. It's an abandon or realignment of an old alignment of the Skykomish River. It's basically a stream that provides flood management. It floods when the river floods, and otherwise it's not a very free-flowing stream by any stretch of the imagination. Associated with the stream are wetlands. There's shoreline designation on the site. There's a native growth protection area on the site that was overlaid over it in order to protect the streams and wetlands. There's steep slopes and a heavy wooded area up in this area north of the stream. And then there's floodplain issues. And the floodplain issues have been a really interesting investigation, if you will, for us. I don't know how familiar you are with where FEMA's at right now, but FEMA has proposed some floodplain maps across the country that are considerably more restrictive than what the entire country has been used to in the past. Those floodplain maps are proposed, and if implemented, they have an impact on this site. More of the site would be in the floodplain than would under the old maps. Although the old map or the new maps have not been adopted, we took the position of what if they are. We took the worst case scenario and assumed that the more restrictive floodplain designation would be applied to this site at the time of development. So who knows what will happen with FEMA. They're in lawsuits with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and everybody else on the validity of their new mapping. We took the worst case scenario to avoid backtracking later and really for transparency purposes. With the environmental constraints, if you will, identified, we came up with a developable area, which is shown on this map as sort of the not very pretty brown color there. The developable area is basically 200 feet south of the stream, and meaning that 200 feet would be assumed as setback areas from the streams and wetlands. Whether or not all that 200 feet is in the native growth protection area or the shoreline designation or the wetland designation didn't really matter to us. We considered it not available. The parcel D up in the north corner there, you'll see there's a high and dry spot. Well, you can't tell that, but that's a high and dry spot of the property where development would also be appropriate. It's one of the highest parts of the site. And so we looked at that as a potential for something. I don't really know what would go up there, but it is considered developable area. Interesting to note the figures in the bottom left corner, gross area of almost 43 acres, developable area of 11. One of the things that made us stop and take pause and really think about this is 75% of the property is dedicated, donated, to mitigation and environmental enhancement. Could really do something cool with the site if we were given that opportunity. Off-site constraints, traffic, transportation, we're right on to. WashDOT's got all kinds of plans for however many years of what will happen to SR2. We recognize there's a coordination factor there. Aesthetic impacts, people will definitely be able to see this project. It's the gateway to the city, if you will. As well as homes to the north would be able to see whatever occurs there. There's a potential for noise impacts that was brought up in some of the past environmental documentation. Public utilities and services, not a lot to say about there. The area is within the UGA. It's designated for sewers. It's included in the water service area. Police, fire, schools, all of that would be slightly impacted, and that would certainly be on the developer to decide and determine what to do there at the time of development. And then cumulative impacts, again, is something that when you're all done with the process, you look at, so what's the big picture? How does this impact the community? And so with all that in mind, we came up with the three development scenarios, if you will, associated with the alternatives I mentioned earlier. So it's hard to see the difference between the three because under any of them, you could have about the same amount of developable area, about the same amount of building size. All three scenarios assume that setback from the streams for protection of the environmental issues on the site. All three scenarios propose not touching the northern portion of the site where the steep slopes and the wooded area provides a nice buffer from the homes to the north. No activities planned there. And again, if you look down at the left-hand side, you'll see it's the no action. the rezone to general commercial and then the mixed use. The no action, from a traffic and transportation standpoint, we looked at a mixture of daycare, church, and I think a gym, a physical fitness kind of center. Alternative two would be maybe a commercial store, a bigger store with some sundry uses, you know, the deli and the Starbucks and the other things that you find in the little strip next to a big store. And then alternative three, I was looking at that as maybe it would be a campus site office building or something to that effect. And to make sure we consider the worst case scenario up in the upper north corner there, we assume that would be a multifamily development of some sort. Not sure how feasible these are, not sure what the developer might do at the end of the day. The purpose of this was to establish what could happen and whether or not there were available mitigation measures under your existing code that would allow for a balance of development and environmental protection on the property. So once we developed the scenarios, we looked at the potential impacts and the mitigation measures. And here again, the scientists aren't with me tonight. I thought I would just sort of mention these, and perhaps in our discussion we can identify what you'd like to hear more about next week. But topography and soils is sort of the first element you look at in under SEPA. Again, the steep slopes would be preserved in their natural site. Because so much of the site is in the floodplain under the new flood or the proposed floodplain map, cut and fill was a big thing for us to look at. If you fill a site in order to build within the floodplain, you take away a certain amount of flood storage, and so you have to put that compensatory flood storage somewhere. We looked at doing that on site. We looked at combining that with wetland and shoreline mitigation, taking in the buffer areas, grading, replanting, and enhancing the shoreline areas so that it could function as a true flood management ecosystem, if you will, so that we could enhance habitat, protect the native growth protection area, avoid impacts to the wetlands, enhance them, as I said. No development is contemplated or I think would ever be allowed under permitting within the actual wetland boundaries or the shoreline boundaries. We're talking about using the buffers for a good environmental protection purpose. Aesthetics, noise, light, and glare are all discussed in the EIS. That's all regulated by your code during the permitting process. Obviously, the buildings would have to comply with whatever performance standards that the city put forth at the time. Traffic and transportation, again, coordination with WashDOT was the biggest thing there, making sure that we have the ingress and egress safely provided and making sure that it was consistent with the long-range plans for SR2. Public services, as I mentioned before, utilities would have to be extended, fire protection would be provided. Those things are all addressed in the draft EIS. In summary, I guess our findings and opportunities for the site. This was eye-opening for me. I wasn't sure where we were headed when we started. I was truly impressed that the site does have a tremendous amount of potential. It's kind of a rare opportunity in my mind to take a site that's so challenged by environmental constraints and be able to figure out how you can achieve development, community needs, economic development, and environmental protection and enhancement on one site. The way to do that, in our mind, is to rezone. It's a lot to take on for anything less than a commercial development in terms of costs and fees. But we found that the current condition of the site, the shoreline and the wetland areas, is poor and getting worse. They're overgrown with nuisance vegetation. Canary grass and blackberries are really kind of choking the stream, if you will. The existing code provides us an opportunity to kind of stop the deterioration of the site and enhance the sensitive areas. The current code provides the opportunity to do that. We find flood management to be a huge issue.
I'm sorry, could you please?
We know that flood management is an issue for the Skycomish River and the region in general, And again, there's an opportunity on this site to really benefit the community in that area. Lastly, the property location is really unique. It is a gateway to the community. It's right there on SR2. We've been told that past studies for the city have indicated that there's a shortage of commercial property. Development along SR2 makes sense in that regard. And the proposal supports and encourages both regional and local economic development. And I could go on and on, but in the interest of time, I would turn it back over and ask you what else can we provide.
Thank you, Susan. That was a very good presentation. Commissioner, do you have any questions? I'm sure you do have some questions. Commissioner Jensen, you've listed
the public hearing date as September 5th, which is a Thursday. Is that normal? I thought they were usually on either nights of the meeting or the council's meeting.
Paul? Yeah, we're holding this as a standalone public hearing. We thought it would be a pretty involved turn and decided it might be best to hold it on as a special public hearing. It's not a planning commission meeting, although I'm hoping that, that there'll be enough commissioners who would attend. I mean, we'll post it as a public meeting, but we wanted the focus to be on collecting, soliciting information from the public on this as a standalone exercise, and we would be discussing it further at the commission meeting following that public hearing.
Commissioner Demarest?
Paul, thank you. And Steve, I was going to ask the same question. So, Paul, who's going to be conducting the hearing?
Staff. We will conduct the hearing, and Melissa will be there as the official, the CEPA official for the city.
And what time on it? Yeah.
7:00.
Commissioner Jensen?
Something we did last meeting, talking about the other issue we've been dealing with, which is that marijuana interim regulation that we've recommended or pushed off to the city council. I'm curious, now knowing that that's kind of behind us, or at least partly behind us, the notion of general commercial is covered in that regulation as a potential area for marijuana retailers. I'd like to know if any of this study includes an additional of the overlays that we were looking at as to would this area be a potential additional area for that type of activity.
It certainly wasn't considered as a commercial use. Didn't even cross my mind, really.
We just did it last time,
yeah,
too. So
interesting. The proposal put before you today is to adopt a zoning, and anything that would be proposed under that zoning would have to go through the permitting processes. So between now and the time and whenever you had an overlay, this property would be subject to it in their permitting processes. So,
and then along that same lines, and again, it's too soon.
Right.
I'm not sure this is the direction you want to go, or if we are be pushing it. Just what I'm saying is that have you looked at a zoning that's more industrial? Because I know we have potential uses you might find under the industrial side of things.
We did not look at industrial. We looked extensively at what's allowed under mixed use and general commercial, and that seemed to cover pretty much the gamut of what would be expected here. I would say that industrial, at the time of a conditional use permit or whatever, would likely have to do additional traffic studies to sort of make up for any differences. So, no, we did not look at industrial.
Commissioner Sherwood, did you have a question?
No, I don't.
Okay. I know you had a discussion earlier this week, or actually this weekend, And one of the questions I remember you asked was, on a 200-yard or 200-foot buffer, which is two-thirds of a football field, whose regulation is that? Where's that regulation coming from?
Well, two things. One, it comes from the shoreline state management, shoreline master plan that this city adopts as part of the Shoreline State Act from the state. You have to have a 200-foot buffer from certain uses, particularly shorelines that are under shoreline jurisdiction. And then also, our city code regulates streams and has a particular stream buffer, so depending upon the type of the stream and this one is a type 1 stream, it also requires certain buffers. So, and then there's, as she mentioned, other critical areas on site. So the native growth protection area may also require, so there's a series of overlays of different buffers that are required, but the 200 foot is the furthest extent, and that comes from the shoreline.
Okay, yeah. And 200 foot is what you've adopted for this whole parcel?
In the native growth protection area, essentially, yes.
Okay.
There's several things stack on top of each other to make that make sense for the native growth protection areas, so that's about a 200-foot swath.
Okay. All right. I just needed to know where that came from, because I know there are different buffers for different things.
Yeah.
And then all this shows up is 200-foot everywhere, so I was just curious where that...
Yeah.
It does get pretty complicated in terms of the numbers of buffers and the areas required.
All right. Great. Okay. That answers my question.
There is a map as well, I think, do you know the appendix number that shows what is adopted currently under the city's shoreline plan?
Okay.
It's this one. And so if you can see the different colors here, the yellow is the wetland buffer, the blue is the shoreline buffer, and over top that is a native growth protection area. So they kind of all overlap, and some are a little smaller and some are a little bigger. So take the common sense approach and take the worst case.
That's
what we did.
Okay. That's where that came from.
Yeah, I'd like to point out Appendix I in the document has the actual map that's adopted as part of the shoreline program for the city of Monroe.
Okay, I'll find it. There's a lot of pages.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else? Commissioners, any other questions? Commissioner Jensen?
You show on the proposed use a road going, what is that, east-west? What is that actually connecting to? I mean, not only to there, but on the other maps showing the potential is there. What is that road connecting to?
That is access that was sort of, if you see, it's kind of hard to see, but there's a little notch in the property right down here that's been set aside for access when WashDOT purchased the frontage from SR2, and so access was provided through there, and so it would eventually connect up to SR2 at a point where WashDOT said was reasonable during the last processes.
So
another thing that would have to be worked out during the development plan.
So go back to page 4, but I don't know what slide that is. The slide that shows developable area 11 acres. This one?
Yeah.
It looks like right on the right-hand edge. Is that an existing road? Would you be connecting to that, or would you be making a new intersection to US-2?
The assumption was that it would be that intersection there.
That existing intersection.
That existing intersection. That was assumptions that were laid out by WashDOT and everyone else at the time. And that's why I said several times that anything would have to be consistent with WashDOT's current plans, and we all know that those aren't exactly set in stone, and they seem to be changing, so...
And sometimes those plans don't align with what we want.
Exactly, and rather than, I'll say it wastes money on trying to predict what WashDOT would do, we simply acknowledge the fact that this is what WashDOT has told us, and it would need to be confirmed.
So if WashDOT said, no, you can't use that road, it comes straight out to US-2...
That'd be great.
Would you have to then redo any of this study?
No,
No,
we wouldn't. It would simply be a feature of the actual detailed design. And when this property develops, it'll be a stack of plans, yay thick, of all kinds of details like that. Okay. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I can add just a couple of quick things to that.
in the past, WashDOT has based their findings on, one, a roundabout further west where the future bypass will connect with SR2, and then about a quarter mile east of that, which may be at that intersection, maybe slightly east of it to the existing drive, would be the new access point for all of this property. About that much distance from the future roundabout to the 2A intersection, it may be a regular intersection where it may be a roundabout. It depends on what kind of traffic is triggered by the development.
I remember we talked about that previously. I also, did I read in here somewhere, because I read a lot, but I think I read here somewhere there was talk about another access. Am I getting that mixed up with
That's an interesting subject as well. So we have the, we have this parcel here.
Right.
Rather than come up and cross the stream here, the notion was brought forth that there is an easement here, it's a utility easement, but if that were to be extended into a transportation easement, we could avoid a stream crossing and perhaps get into that portion of the site a little cheaper, easier, cleaner. But we don't have that easement now, so we mentioned it as an alternative that the property owner may wish to explore.
Okay, so that would be an access to the parcel D?
Yes.
But there would be a separate access then to the other parcel?
Yeah, the first would go here, and this would be a development of some sort. And then it's just kind of odd that this is set off aside, and it was brought to our attention that, geez, if you just came up here and went here, you could really access that portion easier. If the two developments happen to be unrelated, that might make complete sense.
Yeah. But then it would avoid having to have two bridges. Right now, you'd have to only have...
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Commissioner Sherwood.
I want to read a little bit off of Appendix I. Shoreline jurisdiction boundaries in this map are approximate. They have not been formally delineated or surveyed and are intended for planning purposes only. Additional site-specific evaluation may be needed to confirm verified information shown on this map. Map data shows the property of the City of Monroe, inaccuracies may exist. The City of Monroe applies the warranties or guarantees regarding any aspect of data depiction. The real estate decisions are to be made using this map. Please contact the City of Monroe Community Development Department to verify the designation. Caveat that I've appraised this property several times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I walked on it, and this is such an enormous overreach of government in every aspect. It's an unconstitutional take in the property based on junk science that's been shoved down our throat. As a soil physicist in a past life, I know it's junk science, as well as anybody that may have worked on this particular project or be hired by anybody else. It doesn't take 200 feet to keep the water clean. I did research on setbacks and buffers. We go from 25 feet, 65 feet, 42 feet, 76 feet. It's junk science. And I'm talking about Puget Sound setbacks.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we take 75% of somebody's property, and it's all regulatory. I understand some of it is of necessity, and that's fine. But what is this nonsense we're dealing with based on shoreline management designation that's dubious to test? A floodplain designation that has no support in fact. The whole thing that you wrote in this about dike protected areas, et cetera, et cetera. And that much of the new deferred mapping may get tossed in the trash and get completely redone. And you know, I could do this for hours, but I won't. So what we're looking at here is nonsense. Government mandated nonsense. I contacted somebody from DOE today. It was just yap, yap, yap about setbacks. So let's face it, the state of science is poor. And then we say, well, the quality of these wetlands is poor. Whose call is that? Who says a wetland is good or a wetland is poor? Someone has to come up with some standard, which is also potentially more junk science piled on top of junk science to begin with. So I see such an overreach here that a property owner having to acquiesce to 75% taking is just unimaginable to me. Just to get something done, to extract the unknown shoreline management designated area, which may or may not exist in fact, by statute or otherwise, well, we'll extract that just to be favorable to those who may be opposed. So, you know, I am retracing old ground here. I believe that what I see here has been properly done as well as possible. And I think we're just wasting our time to spend much more time on this, and just, I'm ready to move the thing forward. I realize we're not at that point yet, but I see junk science squared times junk science. That's a lot of junk science.
Yeah.
We're talking a logarithmic expansion of junk science here. And someone just throws it up. Does it stick on the wall? Does anybody object? Does anybody even know to object? Well, probably not. And I would guess that, if I objected formally, I'd probably get a notice from the IRS eventually that I was being audited. Right? Because I would be going against a liberal, I mean, just such a liberal establishment in this state. You go to other states, that setback would be 50 feet. Now you tell me which is right, which is based on better science. So, I better stop before I keep going.
Anybody else?
Sure.
Commissioner Dennis.
I'm not a soil physicist. I don't know junk science versus not junk science. But I think perhaps you should run for the state legislature and maybe you can do something about it. The question of whether the law is right or not is the one that's before us tonight. The law is there, and the system that we go through here has to respect that, whether you agree with it or not. Thank you for what you brought forward tonight. It's obviously a whole lot more comprehensive than what we had before us before, what the city had before us. Pastor Mayor, thank you as well. I think if you want it to happen, you're approaching it the right way. I do have a few questions. You talk about in the summary, and I'm looking at page one right now, just about the socioeconomic value of the property if it were to be recharacterized and ultimately rezoned to the general commercial. Has there been any economic analysis done to support that statement?
Specific to this property, no. That would be a general statement concerning watching the property deteriorate and sit unused versus a prime piece of property within the UGA being used to its fullest extent. So,
okay.
But it's based on that.
Thank you. This question perhaps might go more to staff, but places, if you have feedback, I'd like to hear it as well. You commented about how the property to the east, which was a part of the phase EIS last year, has been dropped from this application now. And I can certainly understand and appreciate the benefit of this is all under one ownership, and it's that one ownership that has decided to bring this forward. the question I have is whether there's any negative of leaving that hanging piece of property on the east off of this for consideration at this time.
Well, the application, you know, was revised to reduce the area from, what, 68 acres to the 42, that was about a 25-acre piece to the east. And there's a, as I recall, there's a second property that's further east before you reach the city limits. We asked for a legal opinion on if there was any issue with a reduced area in bringing this amendment back. The answer was no. It would be more of a problem perhaps if it were larger, since it had not been considered in the past. But that 25 acres is for a large part is difficult to develop. There's not very much consolidated area that can be built on. It's not to say that it couldn't be filled and mitigated, but it's really the choice of the applicant. And there's, you know, the city, we don't have an issue in any way with not including that property to the east, leaving it as limited open space until there's a reason to change it.
All right, thank you. Your document, Susan, also talks about how this could be, is perhaps a gateway to the city of Monroe. I know that we haven't, as a city, at least as far as I know, defined what we consider would be an appropriate gateway. But I look at this and I struggle with that because maybe I'm getting too much into the comprehensive plan amendment. Perhaps should hold that. Paul, am I getting a little too far afield? I mean, it does talk about gateway in the EIS here.
I'd love to hear what you have said, no.
I'm just trying to see, in my mind, how this is a gateway. I mean, we look at a property where we would ride into a dead-end street and then come back out to the highway and continue west and hit the city of Monroe. So I guess anything that you might have that would help me in that area.
Well, we spoke about the gateway concepts early in the process with the city and knew that there was some discussion of what should occur at the four corners, if you will, as you enter into the city. And I use the term gateway simply as, for me, and as I come into Monroe, it's usually from Stevens Pass, and that would be my first vision of the city. Well, that, I guess the reptile farm is just outside the city, but it's purely to set a stage, if you will, of just recognizing that you have just crossed into the urban growth area, you've crossed into the city of Monroe, and this is potentially the first development that you'll see.
So, in other words, a gateway could be almost anywhere.
Yes, it could.
And the fact that it's set off to the side doesn't really make any difference.
No, I wouldn't think so. It depends on what happens with your gateway overlays in the future and how this property or the adjacent property would want to or would be afforded the opportunity to participate in. So I think that we should acknowledge that gateway concept is as of yet undefined at the city, and perhaps that's appropriate to the comprehensive plan discussion. I don't know that it matters much in the EIS because it's so conceptual, but that may be something that we want to talk about.
Okay, thank you. And looking at the traffic analysis, I don't even feel a need to really touch on what that resources were. They do a great job, they're a great firm, you picked a good partner there.
Yeah.
And in my mind, they've done a very thorough job in looking at the issues with regard to the physical features of the site. The transportation I'm a little bit puzzled by, and I was looking in particular at, I think it's section 3.4, where they talk about traffic counts. And they talk about, we have it here, 20% will travel north to and from the site, and 15% travel south from the site. To me, there's only two ways to travel from the site, and that's either east or west. Can you clarify that a little? And I'm looking at page 7, Gibson's traffic.
Unfortunately, no, I can't. because I really didn't, you know, that's their specialty and they're not with us tonight. But I can make sure that that question gets addressed for next week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, you said it was...
Page 7, section
7 appendix
4, script distribution.
Yeah, I that doesn't add up to me either. But they always seem to have an answer when you ask these questions, so many would travel to friends.
And looking at their drawing, it appears that they've broken it out once you get to Old Lone Road and Main and Highway 2 and Main Street. But
well, yeah. I was wondering if they're thinking that they would come up Lewis Street and then over, or 203, whatever you call it here. I wonder if that's the concept, is that they're migrating from the south into the city rather than accessing the site directly from the city.
Right.
In other words, most of the people are traveling east-west, but a few people are going to come from the south. That's all I can do.
I think some further clarification on that would be helpful. It also seems, I mean, the state, it seems, has been, the WSDOT in particular, has been pretty adamant in the communications that they've directed toward the city on this property, that if there's going to be further development beyond what's already there based on 5 lots, they're going to want a roundabout. It seems like they've been pretty black and white about it. And yet the traffic study seems to focus on turning lanes. If, in fact, the state came back and said, no, you've got to have a roundabout, does that change the analysis in any way?
No, I don't believe it does. It becomes a condition and something that gets worked out in the development, in the permitting process. I guess I don't share the same sort of certainty about WSDOT. Reading back through the letters over the years, they've sort of flip-flopped on that. I guess it remains to be seen, because they have a copy of the draft EIS now, and we would hope that they would comment on it in the next couple of weeks, and certainly something that should be addressed in the final, should they come forth with any sort of clarity again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure that they will not pass up the opportunity to comment, given that they have consistently done so in the past. I think one of the questions, the alternative one, which is the no action alternative.
Mm-hmm.
As I read this, you feel that even with alternative one, there's likely to be significant impacts from any development of the property. And now in the past, it's been talked about for houses in the church, for instance. I was surprised that, and I'm not an expert on land use, I'm not an engineer, but I was surprised at how much impact I sense would be attributed to a no-action proposal.
Well, the limited open space allows for a lot of types of uses, as is pointed out in one of the appendices. Even a home would have to place significant amount of fill on the property to achieve the raising the site up above the proposed floodplain elevation, which would require cut from somewhere, compensatory flood storage, etc. So while those might be reduced by the size of the development, the impacts would still be far and above the same, just in a lesser degree. Less grading would be required, less compensatory storage, but the mitigation measures, I believe, would be very similar. It would just be an order of magnitude difference if it were homes versus the maximum development allowed under limited open space. We felt it was, and I still believe this firmly, that it's most appropriate to give the city a full picture to evaluate all the alternatives under the worst case scenario, which would be the amount of development that was shown here. If a developer came in and only needed an acre of this site, heck, he's got it made. It's not going to be much mitigation at all. But to achieve the highest and best use of the site, I think they would be approaching somewhere 50 to 100% of the development that's shown here in the CIS.
Thank you. That's all for me. Appreciate it.
Commissioner Sherwood?
I hope this is germane. Maybe it's just that this is opening up issues that need to be addressed globally, but we just glossed over something that I think was just so inappropriate. We say we have a poor quality weapon. Someone makes that judgment call. So it falls on the property owner to enhance the wetland to public benefit. And so all of that onus falls on a single party based on junk science and things that may or may not be true. Now I'm trying to understand how that's okay in the United States of America. I think a fair understanding of government is that it protects the people and provides an environment in which commerce can flourish. Everything on here, everything I read in here, is doing its dead level best to keep commerce from flourishing and place a very targeted and specific onus on a single property owner to dress up a wetland which may or may not function any better when it's dressed up than when it's not dressed up. So you tell the owner, you know what, we're going to take 100% of your property. I hope that's okay. Well, but we want you to dress up the wetland. Could you do that for us? Could you spend a couple hundred grand, $10 a foot, plant some trees, pull out some stuff? Is that right or wrong? That is wrong. And it shouldn't be glossed over and assumed, well, we're going to throw that on the property owner and we're not going to give them a permit. Meaner, meaner, meaner. That's what it sounds like to me. This sounds like something that it happens in kindergarten, some of the mentality that's behind this. It's absolutely unbelievable that we would do that here and now in this day and age with all this knowledge that we have. That we would throw that responsibility and that cost and jeopardize the feasibility of a commercial project based on someone's idea that that's a poor quality wetland and it's going to be the owner's responsibility to pay to fix that. We have a much more impacting use here agriculturally from a chemical standpoint than we ever would. If this property was developed, the scrutiny would be suffocating. And yet they go out there and plow within a foot of the wetland and spread who knows what. But that's okay. And there it is.
Comments?
Unbelievable. Thank you. I'll step down from the soapbox.
I'm going to.
Anybody else? Commissioner Rodland.
Yes. I'm curious to see what the hearing is going to come up with. I have some problems with transportation things. I have a problem with roundabouts on Highway 2 for some reason. Every time I drive through Salton, I get mad. And, you know, 20 years from now, that piece of highway right there is going to be four lanes. You're going to see four lanes right there. And you put a roundabout in four lanes, you're in trouble. I'm just going to wait and hear more of the hearings. I want to hear what's going on, and I'll make a mind.
Thank you. I see the down the road possibly doing another thing like they did at Bickford Road where they had enough accidents to say, well, let's put it in. So it probably would end up happening in the long run.
But would it be too close to the, if it stays around about the bypass? Or if that has to become an interchange itself,
no,
would this be too close
to
that?
Bypass. Huh? It's past the bypass.
Right, but if that bypass becomes an interchange because the roundabout doesn't work because it's four lanes, is that interchange too close to this one?
Yeah, I don't know. I just speculated. Commissioner Sherwood.
Paul, the net areas on these lots are all under 5 acres, and I don't know if you can answer this, but would a home on one of these lots, even though the gross acreage is larger than 5, be non-permissible because the net acreage of all the critical areas is under 5 acres?
No, we would count the gross area of the lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, Paul? And I'd like to, if the commissioners don't mind, I'd like to go ahead and allow the someone who wanted to speak.
Sure, thank you. I'll be brief. Once again, it's Jeff Rogers. I live at 127 East Rivermont Drive in Monroe. I'm one of the property owners that lives to the north, second lot from the west. I just wanted to reiterate some of the comments that Lowell Anderson and I made in a letter that you received either today or earlier this week, raising the same concerns that we've raised consistently over the past several years through the many efforts of getting this property rezoned. I would, as Commissioner Demers, the DEIS has really done a great job of kind of addressing a lot of the concerns and issues. And I appreciate that, and thank Pastor Minnick for bearing the expense of helping illuminate some of these questions and concerns. I think, though based on the DEIS, there's no question in my mind that the current LOS zoning is correct. If you look at the Monroe Municipal Code 18.10.045, it says the purpose of a limited open space zoning district is to provide for low density residential uses on land that lack the full range of public services and facilities necessary to support urban development and that are severely impacted by critical areas. It seems to me that defines this particular piece of property. It's got every critical area. There's no public facilities. Whoever is going to develop the property is going to bear significant costs bringing sewer, water, electric, gas. I think the DEIS indicates that the sewer and the water is over a mile, and we all know how costly it is to put in water and sewer. I'm not an engineer. I have no idea what the cost is, but there's no questions. It's millions of dollars to bring the needed public facilities to this site. I think the DEIS acknowledges, and we've spent a lot of time, whether it's junk science or not, it's what the law is, and the city has to respect the law despite Commissioner Sherwood's objections. No question that 25% of the site is developable. I think the DEIS says there's many environmental challenges. Once again, we've been saying that for years. And it's within a floodplain, whether it's existing or not. Anybody who's lived for any period of time has seen that property underwater. So there's no question it's a floodplain. It's exactly where you want to draw the line. The property does flood. One of the concerns that we who abut that property have is they're talking about on-site storage and cut and fill. We own the property above this, and as we've said a number of times, our concern is as you put water in that stream against our hills, the steep slopes, it's going to cause erosion, it's going to cause slope degradation, and ultimately landslides. There's been landslides, a history of landslides. I think our concern is this going to exacerbate that and put property owners up above at risk. I know it's not part of the DEIS, I think, but part of your job, your accountability and responsibility as well as the city council, is to look at the economic reality of developing this property. So you have 10 acres, frankly. You've got this little island, 1 acre. So in effect, it's 10 acres. Which developer is going to pay, I don't know, I think the asking price is $3 million or thereabouts. And then faced with 10 acres of developable property, no public facilities, and I think the city has indicated that it's going to be solely the developer's responsibility to bring those public facilities, sewer, water, gas, electric, to the site. Very costly. I think short shrift is being given to the access issues. The state has been pretty clear that you're going to either put a roundabout or you're going to have to do a frontage road. And I think there's been some discussion in the past the frontage road would have to go back to the reptile place, which is fairly extensive. Frontage roads are very expensive. Roundabouts are very expensive. You start tallying this up. Before you rezone the property and it sits idle for 30 years, does it make sense to take a hard look at what's really the chances of a developer developing this property and for what? In addition to the traffic, there's all the critical area mitigation. So you've got all these costs, and it's going to cost money to deal with this mitigation. Right or wrong, that's what the law provides for. So I think from our perspective, somebody needs to take a hard look at, and it's not the DES responsibility, but before you go ahead and rezone this, do a comprehensive plan amendment, how likely is it this can be developed? And if you want to see this general commercial sit idle for 20, 30 years, when the city has an abundance of commercial property. We got a Ford dealership down the street that's been idle for 4 years, empty, like a dust bowl, for crying out loud. There's a whole bevy of unused commercial property, empty buildings in the city. So I don't think there's a crying need at this time to move forward, given all these challenges and issues. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Anybody else want to comment? I'd like to make one comment here. Is I'm still stymied as to why we are so concerned about somebody buying that property and having it cost them millions of dollars. I mean, it's not going to cost me millions of dollars. It's going to cost the developer millions. So I'm just, it just doesn't sink right in my head to have that concern about somebody developing that property.
Would you like me to respond to that? Your thoughts?
It's up to you if you would like to come up, give your name and address.
Bo Williamson, 129 East Grimont Drive. In answer to your question, look at it from our perspective. There's several hundred homes up on the hill. You want to rezone something that has been limited open space for many, many years to general commercial. To me, that affects my property value. As my value goes down, so does the house across the street. So you're devaluing a whole community for the benefit of something that may never be built. And I'm unalterably opposed to that. Thank you.
Okay. So that's a different, to me, that's a different argument. I can understand that, but what I stated earlier is, you know, why we were so concerned about, you know, some development cost. That's just me. I'm sorry.
Something I might note is that sometimes we think about just the developer, and I know issues come up about there doesn't seem to be enough structure of getting other fees or mitigations that might help them, you know, or help the traffic. There are certain phones they use, and they pay just a tiny sliver of that, so it might. We should be concerned about if a developer comes in and they just do the bare minimum to get what they need, and it doesn't help anything around us.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Demarest?
Thank you. Question for you, Paul. We touched on this briefly when I asked my earlier questions, but the city does have an economic element to our comprehensive plan currently. Should this DEIS have had any economic analysis in light of that, in your opinion?
Well, as a city, we have no authority to to do economic feasibility studies for private development. We have the ability. We could develop full pro forma for this property for development, but we don't have the authority to do that. And by practice, and I believe by the tenants set forth for comprehensive planning, the public agency cannot consider whether or not this is a profitable venture for the private developer. We do have a role in determining if there is a exploring any potential cost issues with public services. The developer will build sewer and water. Are there issues that may come with that in terms of taking ownership and maintaining that kind of a system? And does it have an undue impact on, say, police services? I don't believe it does, but that's where we can do some judgment of economic impact to the public and to the public jurisdiction. But we're hands off on whether a developer might find this, you know, feasible to develop and to make the numbers for. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sort of, I think. Melissa, you're our CEPA official. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, yes, and that I guess I was thinking about this when the question was first posed. Sometimes this occurs at the time of annexation, and that question comes before the city council at the prior to when the city decides to bring land to the city is when you would want to consider the economic analysis of bringing that into the city. But I guess that decision was made quite a while ago, and I don't know the history because I haven't been here as long. But you can often find that city councils might require an economic analysis at the time before annexation to see if it makes sense. So I just wanted to add that thought there.
I wasn't here at the time, but I think this was annexed before GMA.
1970, yeah. Originally. Yeah, in annexations, in many cases, an economic analysis is done. And one of the basic questions is this a feasible annexation for the city's coffers? Are we taking on something that's going to drain those the public funds with no return? What's the benefit?
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Commissioner Sherwood?
It would certainly seem inappropriate to me for someone to come in and say, you know, I want to build a mini loop in Monroe when we got one vacant. And we sit down at a REACT conference and say, you know, we just don't think you're going to make it, so we're going to turn down the permit. That's inappropriate. And it's inappropriate for us to be sticking our nose at whether or not it's economically feasible to do whatever on this property. That's none of our business.
Commissioner Ratton?
In response to that, if the city has to pay for some of this stuff that we're talking about, then it becomes our responsibility. And it has happened many times in the city of Monroe. We got stuck with an electricity bill on Kelsey project that we didn't know about because we didn't put a big enough one system in. And we got the cop of that. When we did the Pryor Boulevard and tapped into Highway 2, you wouldn't believe the intersection of our city. And you take the sewer line and we ran to the farm. I forgot what that cost, but it was a puzzle. So all this, if the city has to pay for it, we're going to be in trouble. I don't see how, well, we'll see what happens.
I don't see how we would end up paying for any all the rest of that. I think there's really that the effect on public services, whether or not it would drain the coffers or not fill the coffers, would be part of the analysis. But beyond that, it's none of our business.
Anybody else? Okay. Then let's move on to the next item on the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, before we do that, can we talk just a little bit about
process going forward. We have a hearing on the 5th, which is being conducted by the city. It's an informational gathering hearing, as I understand. I want to comment on the draft EIS. Can you share with us a little bit further the process between now and when Planning Commission is done with this, and whatever?
Can you look at the process slide?
Oh, yes.
Well, this is the process for the EIS, and we deliberately left off the steps for the comp plan amendment process, which is really running parallel with this. But this will be coming back to the commission. Let's see, we'll meet again on September 9th, and we'll bring back the DEIS, share the results of the public hearing, what information came out from there. And along with that, I think we'll begin our, several weeks of deliberations on the comp plan amendments. Land use will be done. We're going to be bringing back a little more updated version of economic development, housing, and probably capital facilities, and we'll have to be considering those along with East Monroe and the school mitigation fees that's going to come around again for some form of action. So we'll be starting that process in earnest later in September, and there is a public hearing before the commission for the comp plan amendments, the cumulative, considering it as cumulative in a public hearing, mid to late October. And
public hearing for
the comp plan amendments.
Okay.
Right. This EIS would be the final, would be issued on the end of September, and that may or may not be appealed in some way to the hearing examiner, but that would follow the same, again, another parallel path with those comp plan amendments. There will be no action taken if the East Monroe project is held up in appeals, or is appealed to a higher level in the process. The council would not take action on this amendment if it's in the midst of some kind of appeal process. The other amendments can be acted on. And we're scheduled to send a recommendation to council, I'm thinking mid-November, before Thanksgiving, I think. Then council will, they'll see it a couple of times before you forward your recommendation, and then they'll have a couple of meetings in December for a first and second reading on the ordinance for the amendments. Next time we come together, I'll bring a detailed schedule of both this and the comp plan, how they relate, and what the next,
thank you,
what 2-3 months is going to bring.
Thank you, Paul.
Commissioner Shulman?
Where will the hearing examiner get involved potentially in this?
Only if the draft EIS is not appealable, it's a process for collecting comments, and then the EIS will be revised, or every comment will be responded to. It'll either be, this is addressed in section so-and-so, or that there may be some changes to the EIS to address the comment. But once that's done, we will issue the final EIS. And there is a period, I think, of 15 working days for, that's an appeal period. So someone could appeal that final EIS, the question is adequacy or some aspect of it. If that happens, then that would go to the hearing examiner. I don't quite recall. I think early November. And once the hearing examiner decision is made, there's another period for reconsideration. I can say, no, I think you're wrong, reconsider. And so there will be, if that happens, there will be a ruling on the reconsideration. And then beyond that, it's potentially an appeal to the higher court system.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you.
We'll have more detail, but I can share that in a schedule that outlines all these at the next meeting.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Tonight, we must say we deliberately pull it out from this process.
Okay. Before we move on, I just want to say again, Susan, you and the team did an awesome job bringing this stuff, bringing this to us. And I just compliment you on the great job that you guys did.
Thank you very much. And I know I speak for Pastor Minnick and my whole team, and thank you for your time tonight. It helps us prepare for the public hearing. I think we know where we need to beef up our presentation a little bit, give you a little bit more information next week, and hopefully this will.
I hope to be there myself to see how that goes.
Okay. Thanks again.
Take care.
Excuse me. Thank you. You did more than this thing, and I've done through your
PowerPoint. Moving on, Scott,
I really appreciate it.
Yes.
But we'll be in touch because I don't
think agree with that. Staff, from my understanding, maybe hasn't gotten too far along. I'm wondering if that would be appropriate to
Let's ask staff.
Commissioner Sherwood is exactly right. We have little or no progress to share to make worthwhile to discuss. And Jeff's been out of time for a bit, so he's not done anything anymore with the economic element. So next meeting, they will both be back in your hands, and hoping to have a third element with that as well.
Okay. Because I went and looked at the attachment, the PDF, that it was
attachment
kind of blank page.
I never got it.
Well, I'm fine with that. Commissioners, any other comments on that? Well, then that moves us to discussion by commissioners and staff. Staff?
A couple of things. How many of you think you might go to the public hearing next week? Okay, we're going to post it as a potential commission, post the public meeting for that.
Okay,
good. I think that'll be informative to see, well, to get more detail from the presenter, but also to see what sort of testimony comes about that night.
Yeah, can I ask about that? We understand now that that hearing is specifically about this draft EIS.
Right.
And I know that people are going to want to comment on the comp plan and the zoning part of that. Is there something that we can, not just in some minutes and here sitting down after 200 people have lined up to speak, is there something we can disseminate the information that if you want to talk about zoning, wait for this other public hearing?
I think that's pretty well explained before, at the presentation.
Right, but I thought, people already showed up. They're going to want to say something, even if it's...
Yeah, and they will.
It's difficult to separate the two.
Yeah.
But since this is a formal public hearing for the record, the testimony is limited to the draft EIS by law, basically. But so it's easy to veer off the path.
Yeah.
Would you chair that meeting, Paul? Would that be you that chairs?
Myself or maybe Melissa, between the two of us. And actually, we checked with our
daughter.
We didn't check with our attorney.
We need a clock
to do that.
We have to run the clock?
Yes. Yeah. We'll run the clock. But we do have the authority and ability to conduct a public hearing, as that staff does not take a setting body.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. That's why I want to get to see how the process.
So would we be up here, just not?
No.
No.
Okay.
No. We'll be lucky to be out in
the... Might
be out in the apartment.
I'd also like to point out the public hearing is not actually required per the law, but we're holding one because it makes sense if we want to get input and comments, and so some folks think it's required, but it is not required in this instance on the draft. But we're holding it as a matter of soliciting public comments. So.
Now I was talking to Councilman Williams and Kurt Geary, and they mentioned something about possibly having a public hearing for city council. Is that necessary or? having this public hearing, will that circumvent that, or are they wrong?
There's no public hearing, formal public hearing scheduled with the council.
Okay.
There would not be one. This would be the only public hearing, as Melissa said, it's really an extra.
I think when you consider the actual amendment, that would be the standalone public hearing. And then if there were an appeal in front of the hearing examiner, that would also be another public hearing per. Yeah. Those are the two that are required, okay. As I understand, right, Paul?
Right.
Yeah, those are the two that, you know, have to the process.
For the draft, but for the EIS, the only public hearing that we're having is the one Thursday?
In September. The 5th.
Yes. Yes.
And that's actually not a required public hearing.
So the ones for the draft amendment.
That's right.
There would be two public hearings?
There's an appeal.
Normally there's one public hearing with the commission on the amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And council can choose to decide to hold another public hearing, but it's not required.
Does tonight's discussion and presentation become a part of that record of that public hearing on the 5th?
Not of the record of the from the public hearing. It becomes part of the project record. I mean, in that sense. But in an appeal or legislative process.
An appeal would be a closed record appeal, would it not? An appeal of the final EIS?
Yes.
And so as such, then, it would only be,
I think, from the input from that public hearing as part of the...
You know, it's not a public, it's open. At the hearing examiner, if this appeal to the hearing examiner becomes an appeal for appeal, if memory serves correctly, that's what happened last time.
Okay, I'm just curious because we're in the public comment period, right, of the draft EIS?
Yes.
And so doesn't this amount to public comment this evening, this meeting?
It does. Public comment. Not testimony, but comment.
But
and these are related to the final EIS.
But tonight is for the draft. We're talking about tonight.
Right.
So.
And actually, the public hearing testimony would be related to the final EIS.
That's good.
And, you know, there's a basis for an appeal, possibly, if there are 10 points raised in the public hearing that are not addressed in the final EIS, that may interest someone in filing an appeal on that basis.
Otherwise, and if I understand correctly, comments from the Planning Commission do not become part of the public comment process on the draft EIS. Is that right?
They do by practice.
Yeah, they do. They're part of the Planning Commission minutes.
The commission does not submit written comments, but we're going to treat these comments a little more carefully in the minutes so that they become part of that record.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. It gets complicated, as you know. You've got the draft, and then you've got the comp plan amendment, and they do overlap.
We had the draft.
I'm sorry.
We had the draft.
Yeah, they had the draft.
Actually, we had a draft, then a draft, then the draft.
Yeah. And when we factor the schedule, it's very difficult because there's something happening with each, you know, every day almost between now and the end of December, and you've got to think through, is it on the draft EIS tract, or is it on the comp plan, and is it overlapping, and it's pretty challenging.
Well, from my perspective, having this draft EIS is a far cry from where we were before. This is a lot better. Yeah. Happy to see you.
A couple of quick things. Walmart, we've been working on final closing documents for Walmart. They're scheduled to close at least September 6th. Everything seems to be on track for that closing to take place. And they will likely be under construction sometime after the first of the year. Opening by fall.
Christmas.
Mid-fall of 2014.
greener jobs going to be open?
Pardon me? Oh, yeah. You bet. Sign up.
Can you carry a firearm? Yes.
I have a question. Is the cost of this public?
Pardon me?
Is the cost of this draft EIS public?
No.
Okay.
I don't know what the cost is.
It's paper, yeah.
Right. It's expensive.
Anything else, Paul?
I don't think so. No. Yes. Sun Country Ford, I believe, has now closed for the RV sales center. Tony was in just today.
Did you know about that? No.
Yeah. So that property will not be idle.
So the same thing when I came by tonight.
That's good to hear. That's good.
I couldn't read the name on it.
And did they buy both sides of the street or just the one side?
No, just the east side.
So Ford still owns the other side? Or is that just
the insurance company actually owns the property for all
things. Yeah. I heard a great rumor that we might have a Five Brothers hamburger joint.
Yes. Five guys.
Did you know?
Five guys.
Five guys?
There's a draft LOI signed with a landlord here in town, and they're moving forward. It looks like based on Walmart's elsewhere, there are tenant improvements in January when Walmart starts construction.
Great hamburgers,
by the way. Yeah,
very good.
So when are we going to get a Krispy Kreme?
That'll be next.
That French fry. Okay. Anything else? Staff? Anyone? No? Commissioner Jensen? Mm-hmm. Commissioner Rodman?
If you all want to corn the cob, come by the corn booth at the fairgrounds tomorrow at the Lions Club. Sneak around the back and I'll give you one. You'd better be a conflict of something.
Conflict of profit.
We have calls.
Nothing.
I will not be here for the first meeting in September.
I don't have anything to say, so I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I will move adjourn.
Second.
Motion made by Commissioner Rodman to adjourn, seconded by Commissioner Demarest. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried.
Thank you, Commissioners.